This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell. Part 1. The Marsh. Prologue. 1969. Marsh is not swamp. Marsh is a space of light, where grass grows in the water and water flows into the sky. Slow-moving creeks wander, carrying the orb of the sun with them to the sea, and long-legged birds lift with unexpected grace, as though not built to fly against the roar of 1,000 snow geese. Then within the marsh, here and there, true swamp crawls into low-lying bogs, hidden in clammy forests. Swamp water is still and dark, having swallowed the light in its muddy throat. Even night crawlers are diurnal in this lair. There are sounds, of course, but compared to the marsh, the swamp is quiet because decomposition is cellular work. Life decays and reeks and returns to the rotted duff. A poignant wallow of death begetting life. On the morning of October 30th, 1969, the body of Chase Andrews lay in the swamp, which would have absorbed it silently, routinely, hiding it for good. A swamp knows all about death and doesn't necessarily define it as tragedy, certainly not a sin. But this morning, two boys from the village rode their bikes out to the old fire tower, and from the third switchback, spotted his denim jacket. Chapter 1. Ma. 1952. The morning burned so August hot, the marsh's moist breath hung the oaks and pines with fog. The palmetto patches stood unusually quiet except for the low, slow flap of the heron's wings lifting from the lagoon. And then, Kaya, only 6 at the time, heard the screen door slap. Standing on the stool, she stopped scrubbing grits from the pod and lowered it into the basin of worn-out suds. No sounds now but her own breathing. Who had left the shack? Not Ma. She never let the door slam. But when Kaya ran to the porch, she saw her mother in a long brown skirt, kick pleats nipping at her ankles, as she walked down the sandy lane in high heels. The stubby-nosed shoes were fake alligator skin, her only going-out pair. Kaya wanted to holler out but knew not to rouse Pa, so opened the door and stood on the brick and board steps. From there she saw the blue train case Ma carried. Usually, with the confidence of a pup, Kaya knew her mother would return with meat wrapped in greasy brown paper or with a chicken, head dangling down. But she never wore the gator heels. Never took a case. Ma always looked back where the foot lane met the road, one arm held high, white palm waving as she turned onto the track, which wove through bog forests, cattail lagoons, and maybe, if the tide obliged, eventually into town. But today she walked on, unsteady in the ruts. Her tall figure emerged now and then through the holes of the forest until only swatches of white scarf flashed between the leaves. Kaya sprinted to the spot she knew would bear the road. Surely Ma would wave from there. But she arrived only in time to glimpse the blue case, the color so wrong for the woods, as it disappeared. A heaviness, thick as black cotton mud, pushed her chest as she returned to the steps to wait. Kaya was the youngest of 5, the others much older, though later she couldn't recall their ages. They lived with Ma and Pa, squeezed together like penned rabbits, in the rough-cut shack, its screened porch staring big-eyed from under the oaks. Jody, the brother closest to Kaya, but still 7 years older, stepped from the house and stood behind her. He had her same dark eyes and black hair, had taught her bird songs, star names, how to steer the boat through sawgrass. "Ma'll be back," he said.
"I don't know. She's wearing her gator shoes."
"Ma don't leave her kids. It ain't in 'em."
"You told me that fox left her babies."
"Yeah, but that vixen got her leg all tore up. She'd have starved to death if she'd have tried to feed herself and her kits. She was better off to leave 'em, heal herself up, then whelp more when she could raise 'em good. Ma ain't starving. She'll be back."
Jody wasn't nearly as sure as he sounded, but said it for Kaya. Her throat tight, she whispered,
"But Ma's carrying that blue case like she's going somewheres big."
The shack sat back from the palmettos, which sprawled across sand flats to a necklace of green lagoons, and in the distance, all the marsh beyond. Miles of blade grass, so tough it grew in salt water, interrupted only by trees so bent they wore the shape of the wind. Oak forests bunched around the other sides of the shack and sheltered the closest lagoon, its surface so rich in life it churned. Salt air and gull song drifted through the trees from the sea. Claiming territory hadn't changed much since the 1500s. The scattered marsh holdings weren't legally described, just staked out natural. A creek boundary here, a dead oak there, by renegades. A man doesn't set up a palmetto lean-to in a bog unless he's on the run from somebody or at the end of his own road. The marsh was guarded by a torn shoreline, labeled by early explorers as the graveyard of the Atlantic, because riptides, furious winds, and shallow shoals wrecked ships like paper hats along what would become the North Carolina coast. One seaman's journal read, "Ranged along the shore, but could discern no entrance. A violent storm overtook us. We were forced to get off to sea to secure ourselves and ship, and were driven by the rapidity of a strong current. The land being marshy and swamps, we returned towards our ship. Discouragement of all such as should hereafter come into those parts to settle." Those looking for serious land moved on, and this infamous marsh became a net, scooping up a mishmash of mutinous sailors, castaways, debtors, and fugitives, dodging wars, taxes, or laws that they didn't take to. The ones malaria didn't kill or the swamp didn't swallow bred into a woodsman tribe of several races and multiple cultures, each of whom could fell a small forest with a hatchet and pack a buck for miles. Like river rats, each had his own territory, yet had to fit into the fringe or simply disappear someday in the swamp. 200 years later, they were joined by runaway slaves, who escaped into the marsh and were called Maroons, and freed slaves, penniless and beleaguered, who dispersed into the waterland because of scant options. Maybe it was mean country, but not an inch was lean. Layers of life, squiggly sand crabs, mud-waddling crayfish, waterfowl, fish, shrimp, oysters, fatted deer and plump geese were piled on the land or in the water. A man who didn't mind scrabbling for supper would never starve. It was now 1952, so some of the claims had been held by a string of disconnected, unrecorded persons for four centuries, most before the Civil War. Others squatted on the land more recently, especially after the World Wars when men came back, broke and broke up. The marsh did not confine them, but defined them, and, like any sacred ground, kept their secrets deep. No one cared that they held the land because nobody else wanted it. After all, it was wasteland bog. Just like their whiskey, the marsh dwellers bootlegged their own laws. Not like those burned onto stone tablets or inscribed on documents, but deeper ones, stamped in their genes. Ancient and natural, like those hatched from hawks and doves. When cornered, desperate, or isolated, man reverts to those instincts that aim straight at survival, quick and just. They will always be the trump cards because they are passed on more frequently from one generation to the next than the gentler genes. It is not a morality, but simple math.
among themselves, doves fight as often as hawks. Ma didn't come back that day. No one spoke of it, least of all Pa. Stinking of fish and drum liquor, he clanked pot lids.
Where's supper?
Eyes downcast, the brothers and sisters shrugged. Pa dog cussed, then limp stepped out back into the woods. There had been fights before. Ma had even left a time or two. But she always came back, scooping up whoever would be cuddled. The two older sisters cooked a supper of red beans and cornbread, but no one sat to eat at the table, as they would have with Ma. Each dipped beans from the pot, flopped cornbread on top, and wandered off to eat on their floor mattresses or the faded sofa. Kaya couldn't eat. She sat on the porch steps, looking down the lane. Tall for her age, bone skinny, she had deep tanned skin and straight hair, black and thick as crow wings. Darkness put a stop to her lookout. Croaking frogs would drown the sounds of footsteps. Even so, she lay on her porch bed, listening. Just that morning, she'd awakened to Fat Bat crackling in the iron skillet and whiffs of biscuits browning in the wood oven. Pulling up her bib overalls, she'd rushed into the kitchen to put the plates and forks out, pick the weevils from the grits. Most dawns, smiling wide, Ma hugged her. Good morning, my special girl. And the two of them moved about the chores dance-like. Sometimes Ma sang folk songs or quoted nursery rhymes. This little piggy went to market. Or she'd swing Kaya into a jitterbug, their feet banging the plywood floor until the music of the battery-operated radio died, sounding as if it were singing to itself at the bottom of a barrel. Other mornings, Ma spoke about adult things Kaya didn't understand, but she figured Ma's words needed somewhere to go, so she absorbed them through her skin as she poked more wood in the cook stove, nodding like she knew. Then, the hustle of getting everybody up and fed. Pa not there. He had two settings, silence and shouting, so it was just fine when he slept through or didn't come home at all. But this morning, Ma had been quiet, her smile lost, her eyes red. She'd tied a white scarf pirate style low across her forehead, but the purple and yellow edges of a bruise spilled out. Right after breakfast, even before the dishes were washed, Ma had put a few personals in the train case and walked down the road. The next morning, Kaya took up her post again on the steps, her dark eyes boring down the lane like a tunnel waiting for a train. The marsh beyond was veiled in fog so low, its cushy bottom sat right on the mud. Barefoot, Kaya drummed her toes, twirled grass stems at doodlebugs. But a six-year-old can't sit long, and soon she moseyed onto the tidal flats, sucking sounds pulling at her toes. Squatting at the edge of the clear water, she watched minnows dart between sunspots and shadows. Jody hollered to her from the palmettos. She stared. Maybe he was coming with news. But as he wove through the spiky fronds, she knew by the way he moved, casual, that Ma wasn't home. "You want to play explorers?" he asked.
"You said you're too old to play explorers."
"Nah, I just said that. Never too old. Race ya."
They tore across the flats, then through the woods toward the beach. She squealed as he overtook her and laughed until they reached the large oak that jutted enormous arms over the sand. Jody and their older brother, Murph, had hammered a few boards across the branches as a lookout tower and tree fort. Now, much of it was falling in, dangling from rusty nails. Usually, if she was allowed to crew at all, it was his slave girl, bringing her brother's warm biscuit swiped from Ma's pan. "But today," Jody said,
"you can be captain."
Kaya raised her right arm in a charge.
Run off the Spaniards!
They broke off stick swords and crashed through brambles, shouting and stabbing at the enemy. Then, make-believe coming and going easily, she walked to a mossy log and sat. Silently, he joined her. He wanted to say something to get her mind off Ma, but no words came. So they watched the swimming shadows of water striders. Kaya returned to the porch steps later and waited for a long time. But as she looked to the end of the lane, she never cried. Her face was still, her lips a simple thin line under searching eyes. But Ma didn't come back that day either. Chapter 2 Jody 1952 After Ma left, over the next few weeks, Kaya's oldest brother and two sisters drifted away too, as if by example. They had endured Pa's red-faced rages, which started as shouts, then escalated into fist slugs or backhanded punches, until, one by one, they disappeared. They were nearly grown anyway. And later, just as she forgot their ages, she couldn't remember their real names, only that they were called Missy, Murph, and Mandy. On her porch mattress, Kaya found a small pile of socks left by her sisters. On the morning when Jody was the only sibling left, Kaya awakened to the clatter, clank, and hot grease of breakfast. She dashed into the kitchen thinking Ma was home frying corn fritters or hoe cakes. But it was Jody, standing at the wood stove, stirring grits. She smiled to hide the letdown, and he patted the top of her head, gently shushing her to be quiet. If they didn't wake Pa, they could eat alone. Jody didn't know how to make biscuits, and there wasn't any bacon, so he cooked grits and scrambled eggs and lard, and they sat down together, silently exchanging glances and smiles. They washed their dishes fast, then ran out the door toward the marsh, he in the lead. But just then, Pa shouted and hobbled toward them. Impossibly lean, his frame seemed to flop about from poor gravity. His molars yellow as an old dog's teeth. Kaya looked up at Jody.
We can run. Hide in the mossy place.
It's okay. It'll be okay, he said.
Later, near sunset, Jody found Kaya on the beach staring at the sea. As he stepped up beside her, she didn't look at him but kept her eyes on the roiling waves. Still, she knew by the way he spoke that Pa had slugged his face.
I have to go, Kaya. Can't live here no longer.
She almost turned to him, but didn't. Wanted to beg him not to leave her alone with Pa. But the words jammed up.
When you're old enough, you'll understand, he said. Kaya wanted to holler out that she may be young, but she wasn't stupid. She knew Pa was the reason they all left. What she wondered was why no one took her with them. She'd thought of leaving too, but had nowhere to go and no bus money.
Kaya, you be careful here. If anybody comes, don't go in the house. They can get you there. Run deep in the marsh, hide in the bushes. Always cover your tracks. I learned you how, and you can hide from Pa, too.
When she still didn't speak, he said goodbye and strode across the beach to the woods. Just before he stepped into the trees, she finally turned and watched him walk away.
This little piggy stayed home, she said to the waves.
Breaking her freeze, she ran to the shack, shouted his name down the hall. But Jody's things were already gone, his floor bed stripped bare. She sank onto his mattress, watching the last of that day slide down the wall. Light lingered after the sun as it does, some of it pooling in the room, so that for a brief moment the lumpy beds and piles of old clothes took on more shape and color than the trees outside. A gnawing hunger, such a mundane thing surprised her. She walked to the kitchen and stood at the door. All her life, the room had been warmed from baking bread, boiling butter beans, or bubbling fish stew. Now, it was stale, quiet, and dark.
"Who's gonna cook?"
she asked out loud.
Could have asked, "Who's gonna dance?"
She lit a candle and poked at hot ashes in the wood stove, added kindling, pumped the bellows till a flame caught, then more wood. The Frigidaire served as a cupboard because no electricity came near the shack. To keep the mold at bay, the door was propped open with the fly swatter. Still, greenish-black veins of mildew grew in every crevice. Getting out leftovers, she said, "I'll tump the grits in lard, warm 'em up." Which she did and ate from the pot, looking through the window for Pa. But he didn't come. When light from the quarter moon finally touched the shack, she crawled into her porch bed, a lumpy mattress on the floor with real sheets covered in little blue roses that Ma had got at a yard sale, alone at night for the first time in her life. At first, every few minutes, she sat up and peered through the screen, listening for footsteps in the woods. She knew the shapes of all the trees. Still, some seemed to dart here and there, moving with the moon. For a while, she was so stiff she couldn't swallow. But on cue, the familiar songs of tree frogs and katydids filled the night, more comforting than three blind mice with a carving knife. The darkness held an odor of sweetness, the earthy breath of frogs and salamanders who'd made it through one more stinky hot day. The marsh snuggled in closer with a low fog, and she slept. For 3 days, Pa didn't come, and Kaya boiled turnip greens from Ma's garden for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. She'd walked out to the chicken coop for eggs, but found it bare. Not a chicken or egg anywhere.
"Chicken shits! You're just a bunch of chicken shits!"
She'd been meaning to tend them since Ma left, but hadn't done much of anything. Now they'd escaped as a motley flock, clucking far in the trees beyond. She'd have to scatter grits, see if she could keep them close. On the evening of the fourth day, Pa showed up with a bottle and sprawled across his bed. Walking into the kitchen the next morning, he hollered, "Where's everybody got to?"
"I don't know,"
she said, not looking at him.
"You don't know as much as a cur dog, useless as tits on a boar hog."
Kaya slipped quietly out the porch door. But walking along the beach searching for mussels, she smelled smoke and looked up to see a plume rising from the direction of the shack. Running as fast as she could, she broke through the trees and saw a bonfire blazing in the yard. Pa was throwing Ma's paintings, dresses, and books onto the flames.
"No!"
Kaya screamed. He didn't look at her, but threw the old battery-operated radio into the fire. Her face and arms burned as she reached toward the paintings, but the heat pushed her back. She rushed to the shack to block Pa's return for more, locking eyes with him. Pa raised his backhand toward Kaya, but she stood her ground. Suddenly, he turned and limp-stepped toward his boat. Kaya sank onto the brick and boards, watching Ma's watercolors of the marsh smolder into ash. She sat until the sun set, until all the buttons glowed as embers and the memories of dancing the jitterbug with Ma melted into the flames. Over the next few days, Kaya learned from the mistakes of the others, and perhaps more from the minnows, how to live with him. Just keep out of the way. Don't let him see you. Dart from sunspots to shadows. Up and out of the house before he rose, she lived in the woods and water, then padded into the house to sleep in her bed on the porch as close to the marsh as she could get. Pa had fought Germany in the Second World War, where his left femur caught shrapnel and shattered, their last source of pride. His weekly disability checks their only source of income. A week after Jody left, The Frigidaire stood empty and hardly any turnips remained. When Kaya walked into the kitchen that Monday morning, Pa pointed to a crumpled dollar in loose coins on the kitchen table.
"This hurl'll get you food for the week. There ain't no such thing as handouts," he said. "Everything costs somethin'. And for the money, you got to keep the house up, stove wood collected, and wash the laundry."
For the first time ever, Kaya walked alone toward the village of Barkley Cove to buy groceries.
"This little piggy went to market."
She plodded through deep sand or black mud for 4 miles until the bay glistened ahead, the hamlet on its shore. Everglades surrounded the town, mixing their salty haze with that of the ocean, which swelled in high tide on the other side of Main Street. Together, the marsh and sea separated the village from the rest of the world, the only connection being the single-lane highway that limped into town on cracked cement and potholes. There were 2 streets. Main ran along the ocean front with a row of shops, the Piggly Wiggly grocery at one end, the Western Auto at the other, the diner in the middle. Mixed in there were Cress's Five and Dime, a Penny's, catalog only, Parker's Bakery, and a Buster Brown shoe shop. Next to the Piggly was the Doggone Beer Hall, which offered roasted hot dogs, red-hot chili, and fried shrimp served in folded paper boats. No ladies or children stepped inside because it wasn't considered proper, but a takeout window had been cut out of the wall so they could order hot dogs and knee-high cola from the street. Coloreds couldn't use the door or the window. The other street, Broad, ran from the old highway straight toward the ocean and into Maine, ending right there. So the only intersection in town was Maine, Broad, and the Atlantic Ocean. The stores and businesses weren't joined together as in most towns, but were separated by small vacant lots, brushed with sea oats and palmettos, as if overnight the marsh had inched in. For more than 200 years, sharp, salty winds had weathered the cedar-shingled buildings to the color of rust, and the window frames, most painted white or blue, had flaked and cracked. Mostly, the village seemed tired of arguing with the elements and simply sagged. The town wharf, draped in frayed ropes and old pelicans, jutted into the small bay, whose water, when calm, reflected the reds and yellows of shrimp boats. Dirt roads lined with small cedar houses wound through the trees, around lagoons and along the ocean on either end of the shops. Barkley Cove was quite literally a backwater town, bits scattered here and there among the estuaries and reeds like an egret's nest flung by the wind. Barefoot and dressed in 2 short bib overalls, Kaya stood where the marsh track met the road, biting her lip, wanting to run home. She couldn't reckon what she'd say to people, how she'd figure the grocery money. But hunger was a pushing thing, so she stepped onto Main and walked head down toward the Piggly Wiggly on a crumbling sidewalk that appeared now and then between grass clumps. As she approached the Five and Dime, she heard a commotion behind her and jumped to the side, just as 3 boys, a few years older than she, sped by on bikes. The lead boy looked back at her, laughing at the near miss, and then almost collided with a woman stepping from the store.
"Chase Andrews, you get back here, all 3 of you boys.
They pedaled a few more yards, then thought better of it and returned to the woman, Miss Pansy Price, sales lady in fabric and notions. Her family had once owned the largest farm on the outskirts of the marsh, and although they were forced to sell out long ago, she continued her role as genteel landowner, which wasn't easy living in a tiny apartment above the diner. Miss Pansy usually wore hats shaped like silk turbans, and this morning her headwear was pink, setting off red lipstick and splotches of rouge. She scolded the boys.
"I've a mind to tell y'all's mamas about this. Or better, your papas, riding fast like that on the sidewalk, nearly running me over. What you got to say for yourself, Chase?"
He had the sleekest bike, Red seat and chrome handlebars raised up.
"We're sorry, Miss Pansy. We didn't see you 'cause that girl over yonder got in the way."
Chase, tanned with dark hair, pointed at Kaya, who had stepped back and stood half inside a myrtle shrub.
"Never mind her. You can't go blaming your sins on somebody else. Not even swamp trash. Now you boys got to do a good deed. Make up for this. There goes Miss Ariel with her groceries. Go help carry 'em to her truck and put your shirt tails in."
"Yes, ma'am,"
the boys said as they biked toward Miss Ariel, who had taught them all second grade. Kaya knew that the parents of the dark-haired boy owned the Western Auto Store, which was why he rode the snazziest bike. She'd seen him unloading big cardboard boxes of merchandise from the truck, packing it in. But she had never spoken a word to him or the others. She waited a few minutes, then, head low again, walked toward the grocery. Inside the Piggly Wiggly, Kaya studied the selection of grits and chose a 1-pound bag of coarse ground yellow because a red tag hung from the top. A special of the week. Like Ma taught her. She fretted in the aisle until no other customers stood at the register, then walked up and faced the checkout lady, Mrs. Singletary, who asked,
"Where's your mama at?"
Mrs. Singletary's hair was cut short, curled tight, and colored purple as an iris in sunlight.
"Doing chores, ma'am."
"Well, you got money for the grits, or don't you?"
"Yes'm."
Not knowing how to count the exact amount, she laid down the whole dollar. Mrs. Singletary wondered if the child knew the difference in the coins, so as she placed the change into Kaya's open palm, she counted slowly.
25, 50, 60, 70, 80, 85, and 3 pennies. 'Cause the grits cost 12 cents.
Kaya felt sick to her stomach. Was she supposed to count something back? She stared to the puzzle of coins in her palm. Mrs. Singletary seemed to soften.
"Okay, then. Get on with ya."
Kaya dashed from the store and walked as fast as she could toward the marsh track. Plenty of times Ma had told her, "Never run in town or people will think you stole something." But as soon as Kaya reached the sandy track, she ran a good half mile, then speed walked the rest. Back home, thinking she knew how to fix grits, she threw them into boiling water like Ma had done, but they lumped up all together in one big ball that burned on the bottom and stayed raw in the middle, so rubbery she could only eat a few bites. So she searched the garden again and found a few more turnip greens between the goldenrod, then boiled them up and ate them all, slurping down the pot liquor. In a few days, she got the hang of fixing grits. Although no matter how hard she stirred, they lumped up some. The next week, she bought backbones, marked with a red tag, and boiled them with grits and collard greens in a mush that tasted fine. Kaya had done the laundry plenty with Ma, so knew how to scrub clothes on the rub board under the yard spigot with bars of lye soap. Pa's overalls were so heavy wet she couldn't wring them out with her tiny hands, and couldn't reach the line to hang them, so draped them sopping over the palmetto fronds at the edge of the woods. She and Pa did this two-step, living apart in the same shack, sometimes not seeing each other for days, almost never speaking. She tidied up after herself and after him like a serious little woman. She wasn't near enough of a cook to fix meals for him. He usually wasn't there anyway. But she made his bed, picked up, swept up, and washed the dishes most of the time. Not because she'd been told, but because it was the only way to keep the shack decent for Ma's return. Ma had always said the autumn moon showed up for Kaya's birthday. So even though she couldn't remember the date of her birth, one evening when the moon rose swollen and golden from the lagoon, Kaya said to herself,
"I reckon I'm 7.
Pa never mentioned it. Certainly there was no cake. He didn't say anything about her going to school either, and she, not knowing much about it, was too afraid to bring it up. Surely Ma would come back for her birthday. So the morning after the harvest moon, she put on the calico dress and stared down the lane. Kaya willed Ma to be walking toward the shack, still in her alligator shoes and long skirt. When no one came, she got the pot of grits and walked through the woods to the seashore. Hands to her mouth, she held her head back and called,
"Kiao, kiao, kiao!"
Specks of silver appeared in the sky from up and down the beach, from over the surf.
"Here they come. I can't count as high as that many gulls are," she said.
Crying and screeching, the birds swirled and dived, hovered near her face and landed as she tossed grits to them. Finally, they quieted and stood about preening, and she sat on the sand, her legs folded to the side. One large gull settled onto the sand near Kaya.
"It's my birthday,"
she told the bird. Chapter 3 Chase 1969 The rotted legs of the old abandoned fire tower straddled the bog, which created its own tendrils of mist. Except for cawing crows, the hushed forest seemed to hold an expectant mood as the two boys, Benji Mason and Steve Long, both 10, both blonde, started up the damp staircase on the morning of October 30th, 1969.
"Fall ain't supposed to be this hot,"
Steve called back to Benji.
"Yeah, and everything quiet except the crows."
Glancing down between the steps, Steve said,
"Whoa, what's that?"
"Where?"
"See, there. Blue clothes, like somebody's lying in the mud."
Benji called out,
"Hey, you, what you doing?"
"I see a face, but it ain't moving."
Arms pumping, they ran back to the ground and pushed their way to the other side of the tower's base, greenish mud clinging to their boots. There lay a man, flat on his back, his left leg turned grotesquely forward from the knee, his eyes and mouth wide open.
"Jesus Christ," Benji said.
"My God, it's Chase Andrews. We better get the sheriff." "But we ain't supposed to be out here."
"That don't matter now. And them crows will be snooping around any time now."
They swung their heads toward the cawing as Steve said,
"Maybe one of us ought to stay. Keep them birds off him." "You're crazy if you think I'm gonna stick around here by myself. And I'm betting an engine head you won't either."
With that, they grabbed their bikes, pedaled hard down the syrupy sand track back to Maine, through town, and ran inside the low-slung building where Sheriff Ed Jackson sat at his desk in an office lit with single light bulbs dangling on cords. Hefty and of medium height, he had reddish hair, his face and arms splotched with pale freckles, and sat thumbing through a sports field. Without knocking, the boys rushed through the open door.
"Sheriff!"
"Hey, Steve, Benji, you boys been to a fire?"
"We seen Chase Andrews flat out in the swamp under the fire tower. He looks dead. Ain't moving one bit."
Ever since Barclay Cove had been settled in 1751, no lawman extended his jurisdiction beyond the sawgrass. In the 1940s and 50s, a few sheriffs set hounds on some mainland convicts who'd escaped into the marsh, and the office still kept dogs just in case. But Jackson mostly ignored crimes committed in the swamp. Why interrupt rats killing rats? But this was Chase. The sheriff stood and took his hat from the rack.
"Show me."
Limbs of oak and wild holly screeched against the patrol truck as the sheriff maneuvered down the sandy track with Dr. Vern Murphy, lean and fit with graying hair, the town's only physician, sitting beside him. Each man swayed to the tune of the deep ruts, Vern's head almost banging against the window, old friends about the same age. They fished together some and were often thrown onto the same case. Both silent now at the prospect of confirming whose body lay in the bog. Steve and Benji sat in the truck bed with their bikes until the truck stopped.
"He's over there, Mr. Jackson, behind them bushes."
Ed stepped from the truck.
"You boys wait here."
Then he and Dr. Murphy waded the mud to where Chase lay. The crows had flown off when the truck came, but other birds and insects whirred above, insolent life thrumming on.
"It's Chase, all right. Sam and Patty Love won't survive this."
The Andrewses had ordered every spark plug, balanced every account, strung every price tag at the Western Auto for their only child, Chase. Squatting next to the body, listening for a heartbeat with his stethoscope, Vern declared him dead.
"How long, you reckon?"
Ed asked.
"I'd say at least 10 hours. The coroner'll know for sure." "He must have climbed up last night, then. Fell from the top."
Vern examined Chase briefly without moving him, then stood next to Ed. Both men stared at Chase's eyes, still looking skyward from his bloated face, then glanced at his gaping mouth.
"How many times I've told folks in this town something like this was bound to happen,"
the sheriff said. They had known Chase since he was born, had watched his life ease from charming child to cute teen, star quarterback and town hotshot, to working for his parents. Finally, handsome man wedding the prettiest girl. Now, he sprawled alone, less dignified than the slough, death's crude pluck as always stealing the show. Ed broke the silence.
"Thing is, I can't figure why the others didn't run for help. They always come up here in a pack, or at least a couple of them, to make out."
The sheriff and doctor exchanged brief but knowing nods that even though he was married, Chase might bring another woman to the tower.
"Let's step back out of here. Get a good look at things,"
Ed said as he lifted his feet, stepping higher than necessary.
"You boys stay where you are. Don't go making any more tracks."
Pointing to some footprints that led from the staircase across the bog to within 8 feet of Chase, Ed asked them,
"These your prints from this morning?"
"Yes, sir. That's as far as we went," Benji said. "Soon as we seen it was Chase, we backed up. You can see there where we backed up."
"Okay."
Ed turned.
"Vern, something's not right. There's no footprints near the body. If he was with his friends or whoever, once he fell, they would have run down here and stepped all around him, knelt next to him, to see if he was alive. Look how deep our tracks are in this mud, but there's no other fresh tracks. None going toward the stairs or away from the stairs. None around the body." "Maybe he was by himself, then. That would explain everything." "Well, I'll tell you one thing that doesn't explain. Where are his footprints? How did Chase Andrews walk down the path, cross this muck to the stairs so he could climb to the top, and not leave any footprints himself?"
Chapter 4. School. 1952. A few days after her birthday, out alone, barefooting in mud, Kaya bent over, watching a tadpole getting its frog legs. Suddenly she stood. A car churned through deep sand near the end of their lane. No one ever drove here. Then the murmur of people talking, a man and a woman, drifted through the trees. Kaya ran fast to the brush, where she could see who was coming but still have ways to escape, like Jody Totter. A tall woman emerged from the car, unsteadily maneuvering in high heels, just like Ma had done along the sandy lane. They must be the orphanage people come to get her.
I can outrun her for sure. She'd fall nose first in them shoes.
Kaya stayed put and watched the woman step to the porch's screen door.
Yoo-hoo! Anybody home? Truant officer here. I've come to take Catherine Clark to school.
Now this was something. Kaya sat mute. She was pretty sure she was supposed to go to school at 6. Here they were, a year late. She had no notion how to talk to kids, certainly not to a teacher, but she wanted to learn to read and what came after 29.
Catherine, dear, if you can hear me, please come on out. It's the law, hon. You got to go to school. Besides that, you'll like it, dear. You get a hot lunch every day for free. I think today they're having chicken pie with crust.
That was something else. Kaya was very hungry. For breakfast, she'd boiled grits with soda crackers stirred in because she didn't have any salt. One thing she already knew about life, you can't eat grits without salt. She'd eaten chicken pie only a few times in her life, but she could still see that golden crust, crunchy on the outside, soft inside. She could feel that full gravy taste, like it was round. It was her stomach acting on its own that made Kaya stand up among the palmetto fronds.
Hello, dear. I'm Mrs. Culpepper. You're all grown up and ready to go to school, aren't you?
Yes'm,
Kaya said, head low.
It's okay. You can go barefoot. Other chillen do. But 'cause you're a little girl, you have to wear a skirt. Do you have a dress or a skirt, hon?
Yes'm.
Okay, then. Let's go get you dressed up.
Mrs. Culpepper followed Kaya through the porch door, having to step over a row of bird's nests Kaya had lined up along the boards. In the bedroom, Kaya put on the only dress that fit, a plaid jumper with one shoulder strap held up with a safety pin.
That's fine, dear. You look just fine.
Mrs. Culpepper held out her hand. Kaya stared at it. She hadn't touched another person in weeks, hadn't touched a stranger her whole life. But she put her small hand in Mrs. Culpepper's and was led down the path to the Ford Crestliner, driven by a silent man wearing a gray fedora. Sitting in the back seat, Kaya didn't smile and didn't feel like a chick tucked under its mother's wing. Barclay Cove had one school for whites. First grade through 12th went to a brick two-story at the opposite end of Main from the sheriff's office. The black kids had their own school, a one-story cement block structure out near Colored Town. When she was led into the school office, they found her name, but no date of birth in the county birth records, so they put her in the second grade, even though she'd never been to school a day in her life. Anyhow, they said, the first grade was too crowded, and what difference would it make to Marsh people who'd do a few months of school, maybe, then never be seen again? As the principal walked her down a wide hallway that echoed their footsteps, sweat popped out on her brow. He opened the door to a classroom and gave her a little push. Plaid shirts, full skirts, shoes, lots of shoes, some bare feet, and eyes, all staring. She'd never seen so many people. Maybe a dozen. The teacher, the same Mrs. Ariel those boys had helped, walked Kaya to a desk near the back. She could put her things in the cubby hole, she was told, but Kaya didn't have any things. The teacher walked back to the front and said,
"Catherine, please stand and tell the class your full name."
Her stomach churned.
"Come now, dear, don't be shy."
Kaya stood.
"Miss Catherine Danielle Clark," she said,
because that was what Ma once said was her whole name.
"Can you spell dog for us?"
Staring at the floor,
Kaya stood silent. Jody and Ma had taught her some letters, but she'd never spelled a word aloud for anybody. Nerves stirred in her stomach. Still, she tried.
G-O-D.
Laughter let loose up and down the rows.
Shh! Hush, y'all! Miss Ariel called out. We never laugh, you hear me? We never laugh at each other. Y'all know better than that.
Kaya sat down fast in her seat at the back of the room, trying to disappear like a bark beetle blending into the furrowed trunk of an oak. Yet nervous as she was, as the teacher continued the lesson, she leaned forward, waiting to learn what came after 29. So far, all Miss Ariel had talked about was something called phonics, and the students, their mouths shaped like O's, echoed her sounds of ah, ah, o, and oo, all of them moaning like doves. About 11 o'clock, the warm, buttery smell of baking yeast rolls and pie pastry filled the halls and seeped into the room. Kaya's stomach panged and fitted, and when the class finally formed a single file and marched into the cafeteria, her mouth was full of saliva. Copying the others, she picked up a tray, a green plastic plate, and flatware. A large window with a counter opened into the kitchen, and laid out before her was an enormous enamel pan of chicken pie, crisscrossed with thick, crispy pastry, hot gravy bubbling up. A tall black woman, smiling and calling some of the kids by name, plopped a big helping of pie on her plate. Then some pink lady peas and butter, and a yeast roll. She got banana pudding and her own small red and white carton of milk to put on her tray. She turned into the seating area, where most of the tables were full of kids laughing and talking. She recognized Chase Andrews and his friends, who had nearly knocked her off the sidewalk with their bikes, so she turned her head away and sat at an empty table. Several times in quick succession, her eyes betrayed her and glanced at the boys, the only faces she knew. But they, like everyone else, ignored her. Kaya stared at the pie full of chicken, carrots, potatoes, and little peas, golden brown pastry on top. Several girls, dressed in full skirts fluffed out wide with layers of crinolines, approached. One was tall, skinny, and blonde, another round with chubby cheeks. Kaya wondered how they could climb a tree or even get in a boat wearing those big skirts. Certainly couldn't wade for frogs. Wouldn't even be able to see their own feet. As they neared, Kaya stared at her plate. What would she say if they sat next to her? But the girls passed her by, chirping like birds, and joined their friends at another table. For all the hunger in her stomach, she found her mouth had gone dry, making it difficult to swallow. So after eating only a few bites, she drank all the milk, stuffed as much pie as she could into the milk carton, carefully so nobody would see her do it, and wrapped it in the roll in her napkin. The rest of the day, she never opened her mouth. Even when the teacher asked her a question, she sat mute. She reckoned she was supposed to learn from them, not them from her. Why put myself up for being laughed at? She thought. At the last bell, she was told the bus would drop her 3 miles from her lane because the road was too sandy from there, and that she had to walk to the bus every morning. On the way home, as the bus swayed in deep ruts and past stretches of cord grass, a chant rose from the front. Miss Catherine Danielle Clark. Tall, skinny blonde and round, chubby cheeks, the girls at lunch called out. Where you been, Marsh Hen? Where's your hat, Swamp Rat? The bus finally stopped at an unmarked intersection of tangled tracks way back in the woods. The driver cranked the door open, and Kaya scooted out and ran for nearly half a mile, heaved for breath, then jogged all the way to their lane. She didn't stop at the shack but ran full out through the palmettos to the lagoon and down the trail that led through dense, sheltering oaks to the ocean. She broke out onto the barren beach, the sea opening its arms wide, the wind tearing loose her braided hair as she stopped at the tide line. She was as near to tears as she had been the whole day. Above the roar of pounding waves, Kaya called to the birds. The ocean sang bass, the gulls sang soprano. Shrieking and crying, they circled over the marsh and above the sand as she threw pie crust and yeast rolls onto the beach. Legs hanging down, heads twisting, they landed. A few birds pecked gently between her toes, and she laughed from the tickling until tears streamed down her cheeks, and finally great ragged sobs erupted from that tight place below her throat. When the carton was empty, she didn't think she could stand the pain, so afraid they would leave her like everybody else. But the gulls squatted on the beach around her and went about their business of preening their gray extended wings. So she sat down too and wished she could gather them up and take them with her to the porch to sleep. She imagined them all packed in her bed, a fluffy bunch of warm feathered bodies under the covers together. 2 days later, she heard the Ford Crestliner churning in the sand and ran into the marsh, stepping heavily across sandbars, leaving footprints as plain as day, then tiptoeing into the water, leaving no tracks, doubling back and taking off in a different direction. When she got to mud, she ran in circles, creating a confusion of clues. Then when she reached hard ground, she whispered across it, jumping from grass clump to sticks, leaving no trace. They came every 2 or 3 days for a few more weeks, the man in the fedora doing the search and chase. But he never even got close. Then 1 week, no one came. There was only the cawing of crows. She dropped her hands to her sides, staring at the empty lane. Kaya never went back to school a day in her life. She returned to heron watching and shell collecting, where she reckoned she could learn something.
"I can already coo like a dove," she told herself, "and lots better than them, even with all them fine shoes."
One morning, a few weeks after her day at school, the sun glared white hot as Kaya climbed into her brother's tree fort at the beach and searched for sailing ships hung with skull and crossbones flags. Proving that imagination grows in the loneliest of soils, she shouted,
"Ho, pirates, ho!"
Brandishing her sword, she jumped from the tree to attack. Suddenly, pain shot through her right foot, racing like fire up her leg. Knees caving in, she fell on her side and shrieked. She saw a long, rusty nail sticking deep in the bottom of her foot.
"Pa!" she screamed.
She tried to remember if he had come home last night.
"Help me, Pa!"
she cried out. But there was no answer. In one fast move, she reached down and yanked the nail out, screaming to cover the pain. She moved her arms through the sand in nonsensical motions, whimpering. Finally, she sat up and looked at the bottom of her foot. There was almost no blood, just the tiny opening of a small, deep wound. Right then, she remembered the lockjaw. Her stomach went tight and she felt cold. Jody had told her about a boy who stepped on a rusty nail and didn't get a tetanus shot. His jaws jammed shut, clenched so tight he couldn't open his mouth. Then his spine cramped backward like a bow. But there was nothing anybody could do but stand there and watch him die from the contortions. Jody was very clear on one point. You had to get the shot within 2 days after stepping on a nail, or you were doomed. Kaya had no idea how to get one of those shots.
"I gotta do something. I'll lock up for sure, waiting for Pa."
sweat rolling down her face in beads, she hobbled across the beach, finally entering the cooler oaks around the shack.